Russell, you're ready to continue with your impromptu speak. Thank you for
okay.
Impromptu.
So a question about whether the point sensitive version of the temp directory could reside under the temp directory, under the real temp directory. The way point annotation works in a fairly default configuration is that is what is done. So you will have, when a user logs in, the PAM system will call the PAM namespace module. And in a typical configuration of PAM namespace, you will have it create a directory named slash TMP slash something slash username if it's based on user, or slash TMP slash something slash SLinux context if it's based on context. And so it will be under the same file system. And also, point annotated directories, you can do this for the home directory as well. If you're using the targeted policy of SE Linux, there is no benefit for that. If you're using the strict policy, you could have a user with several roles permitted, and have each role have a different point annotated version of the home directory. And for the MLS policy, you have even more reasons, because you have different levels available. So a user could log in twice with two different levels, and have two different versions of the home directory to match. So I think most typical way of configuring point annotated directories is to have it under the same directory, but that's not required at all. Now, the way that the technology of point annotated directories work is use a feature known as kernel namespaces. And so namespace is there's a system called an application can use called unshare, and that means you'll have to unshare your namespace. And your namespace is no longer shared with the rest of the system. And this is also an option for clone. So when you clone a new process, clone being somewhat equivalent to fork, you can do so with a different namespace. A different namespace means that any mount operations formed on one namespace will not be seen on the other ones. So the way things work, if you want to, for a login process, you would firstly call unshare, so you have a separate namespace. Then you would use a bind mount of slash TMP slash instance slash username to be on slash TMP. And that mount operation will only be seen by the process called unshare and its trial processes. It will not be seen by other processes. And there is also some minor tricks involved in having some mount points be shared. So, for example, you want to have unshared versions of slash temp, for example, to have point annotated temp directories. But slash MNT is something you usually want to have shared namespace for. And this can be done. I've actually documented how to do this. I've written a paper for a conference a couple of years ago about how to do this, which contains all details. So probably if you do a Google search of PAM namespace, unshare, and my name, it'll probably return that. Or, of course, you can email me and I'll give you the link. Now, there's a question about PHP control panels. So first thing is, within the operations of one process and its child processes, unless they have a domain transition, there is no restriction between these processes or no difference in access control between these processes. So, for example, if you have a Apache, it has several processes it runs, and if it runs, you might have, say, for example, PHP running a shell for launching send mail or something send mail. The shell will run under the same security context with the same access. And the send mail program will run with a different context to send the message, but basic shell operations are permitted under the same context. And of course, for PHP itself, PHP runs in the same address space as Apache. So it's part of Apache, and that's all things Apache does. There is no way of making PHP unable to do things Apache does. And in the two cases of control panels, you have a control panel, and its task is to create a new account for a user, change the password for that account, do other related things. SE Linux will be configured to allow these things. Whatever file you store a password in, that process must be able to write to. And there's no restriction on rewriting it. It's hard to imagine a way of effectively controlling these things with a typical Apache PHP setup. You could have a course of a configuration with multiple copies of Apache running different PHP scripts with different security contexts, so they're protected from each other. This is not a difficult configuration. It would not be easy to set up, but it wouldn't be possible to set up. It used to be easier than it is now. In the early versions of SE Linux, you had a single text file containing the bulk of the policy for each daemon. And so for someone who was prepared to modify policy, it was very easy to just copy the file to a new name, run sed on it to change the names of the types and things, and suddenly you had identical configuration that was different. Now, probably the easiest way of doing these things from the same results is through the MMCS policy, my mandatory multi-category security policy. So you could run two different versions of Apache with different sets of categories, which would then protect against each other. My MMCS policy, unlike the Red Hat one, protects against things like ptrace. So you can't use strace and GDB on another process that has different set of categories. Or not, sorry, not unless it has a less set of categories. If you have categories C0 and C1, and you want to ptrace a process with category C0, that's fine, because you just launch a process with that level access. But you can't do it the other way around. Does that address your question, Matt? Okay. We'll talk about it later as well, if you want. Another thing is, can you feel secure with SE Linux without actually being secure? Yeah, of course. I mean, with anything, you can feel secure without being secure, depending on what you do. I mean, for example, so just say you're running a machine, and you do a default Fedora install. And default Fedora install has SE Linux enabled with tailored policy. And tailored policy is good for what it does. And so just say your machine you install has a statically configured IP address. It doesn't run the HTTP client. It doesn't run any daemons. You could conceivably have a machine that has nothing confined by SE Linux that actually needs protection. So you have no daemons that are known to be good target for attack. So in which case, SE Linux isn't actually doing much good, because one of the most serious attack vectors for a desktop user is a compromise of the web browser. And the targeted policy runs web browser with the same security context as the email client, as the shell, as everything else. And so SE Linux totally doesn't protect you from that in targeted policy. In the strict policy, you can run your web browser with restricted access and can get some protection from those attacks. But again, one problem with the strict policy in current implementation is a lack of X support. Now, if you have two programs that are both accessing X, they can send arbitrary window messages to each other. They can sniff each other's window input, so sniff the keyboard. They can copy each other's screen contents, and so basically then do everything to each other. And if you have an X Windows client that is compromised, then with the current released code, there is no protection for you. The latest thing that's being developed for SE Linux is what's called Security Enhanced X, and that aims to solve this problem. So every window message is then arbitrated by SE Linux, and you have the X server implementing the SE Linux access control engine, and have the SE Linux policy loaded by the X server. And then whenever you do operations such as loading a new policy into the kernel or changing Booleans, the kernel will notify the X server, and the X server will then mirror these changes. And so the X server will then perform SE Linux access controls on every relevant operation. This means, for example, when you move a mouse, and window message will go to the windows you move the mouse over. And SE Linux will determine whether a particular window can receive those messages or not. The reason why this code is in the X server, unlike being in the kernel, because right from the start of this Linux project, there have been APIs for applications to query the kernel. So even in the earliest version of SE Linux, you have themes such as cron. And cron would call a kernel to verify security context used for running users' cron jobs. And so this code for the application to query the kernel and say, is a certain operation permitted, has been there right from the start. And for a cron job may execute at most once a minute. And calling a kernel and asking, is a certain a certain operation permitted once a minute, is really not a big deal. For an X server to do a 1,000 kernel requests a second for some of these things, which I think would not be an unreasonable number of X messages, of course wouldn't be reasonable. So they have the X server itself having the code to do these checks, which mirrors the kernel code. So the X server is known as a trusted object name, because it enforces the trust model itself directly. So once Security Enhanced X, which incidentally has a really great acronym, is implemented in use, then we could have web browsers and things running with limited privileges. And would, of course, even, and another thing that's being developed is changes to the targeted versus strict policy separation. So the aim is to gradually bring these two policies closer together, to make targeted have more targets, so eventually it becomes very strict. And so one thing that I think would be possible is have you have you're running the target policy, you have your desktop having undefined domain for most things, and then you have a special domain for your web browser, and you have security enhanced X, so this web browser can't mess with the other programs, and then you'll be reasonably secure against web browser-based attacks. But until that happens, which is probably 6 months away, or at least, maybe a year, until that happens, if your web browser is exploited in a graphical environment, you've lost. And so in that case, I think that some people might install this into the targeted policy and think that they're protected against everything, and they're not. But one thing I think should be noted is that this is the same with any technology. Any protection is not going to solve all problems. And there will always be other things to consider. And you've just got to know what the scope of your technology is. And you know that the scope of the targeted policy is to protect certain targeted daemons, and that's the current scope. And that gives some useful benefits, but it doesn't save you from everything. It doesn't save you from attacks on your user, which is particularly noteworthy given that the majority of Linux systems are single user boxes, effectively. So most Linux boxes have one person logging in as one particular account and nothing else. It used to be the case a few years ago that if you logged onto an IRC channel, and your IRC client revealed that it was running as root, you would get abused by a lot of people and often kicked off the channel. And I've experimented with this because what I often do is running an Xlinux Play Machine. I'd run an IRC client as the user role and log into one of these channels. And I have people say, oh, no, you're insecure. I say, no, I'm using Xlinux. I'm using the user role and not the system role, and so I'm safe. And unfortunately, no one wants to talk to me about these things. They say, let's repeat the mantra of, no, you're insecure, very disappointing. But in recent times when I tried this sort of trolling, I had no response. It seems that now, logging in as root is no big deal, which I think really, in any case, it isn't, because if you're doing everything as one UID and that UID gets cracked, you lose. Whether UID is zero or not zero, probably doesn't make much difference. I mean, sure, if they crack UID zero, it can be a lot harder to find them. But I think for the majority of users, no matter how they get cracked, they won't notice it anyway, unless the attacker stuffs up. So it's probably no difference. And probably in today's typical usage scenarios, the risks of doing everything as root are probably fairly minimal. Unless, of course, you want to actually, you suspect you're, the benefit of not using root, of course, is if you suspect you've been cracked, you can log out, log in as root, and find out what's going on. Whereas if you've been cracked as root, then it's very hard to discover what's going on. So yes, you can feel secure and not be secure, or not be as secure as you feel running SELinux. One thing to know about SELinux is when SELinux access controls are checked after Unix access controls. So if Unix permissions do not allow an operation, then SELinux doesn't even get to see it. So the worst you can face with SELinux is being as insecure as a non-SELinux machine, which isn't that bad. SELinux, you can't misconfigure it and make a machine less secure than a non-SELinux machine. So you can't sort of go negative in terms of security. Okay, do we have more questions at this stage? Okay, how much time do I have left? 3 minutes. Okay, I think there's a lot of things to talk about. Okay, now the main things I want to talk about I've already covered. Shall I finish the talk now or think about some more things, guys? What do you reckon? Think about more things? What's that? This is the only computer I've got with me. Okay, one thing while I've got this up, I should mention. I was given a couple of iPacks a few years ago by a company that wanted to have SELinux working on iPacks. As a sample of an embedded SELinux project. And of recent times, SELinux was not usable on iPacks because the early version of SELinux stored the file security context in a database and the root directory. So you had three files in this hidden database which mapped inodes to security context. And this was actually the second major version of SELinux. The first major version of SELinux had file security contexts stored in otherwise unused fields of the EC2 file system, which means they had different versions of MKFS and FSCK, etc. And the regular versions would not work at all with them. And if you boot a non-SELinux kernel, it would get very unhappy. And it was all more exciting that way. But so that obviously was never going to be support upstream, but this was a demonstration of the technology. So the next major version had its files, extra files in the file system. And it's worked with any file system type that supported inodes. So JFFS2, which is the file system used for this device, faked inodes, because the way JFFS2 works doesn't actually have what we know as inodes, but it fakes them for all many Unix programs that need them. And so that worked with SELinux. So I had SELinux working quite well on my IPACs for a while. And then the latest version of SELinux was released, which uses XADOs to store the security contexts. And XADOs weren't supported by JFFS2 at the time. And so therefore SELinux wouldn't work on IPACs. But a recent thing is one of the Japanese guys made some patches to the file system to support XADOs, and I believe these patches have been pulled upstream. So what I'm going to do now is upgrade my kernel, and I should be able to get SELinux working on my IPAC again, which is part of my to-do list. I've considered actually running a play machine on an IPAC. So you can log into an IPAC remotely as root and try and crack it or something. Yep? I can log in my play machine, I guess. It probably isn't much. I could demonstrate a short order without some time. So if I had like half an hour of downtime to do it without an audience putting in their thumbs, I'd do so, but I'll keep going at this stage, I think. Yep, Matt? Okay, that's a challenging question. What are the major criticisms of SELinux and how do I count them? Okay, probably the biggest criticism of SELinux, the most direct criticism, is to say that the greatest number of web searches on SELinux is about how to turn it off. Now, the reason is that there are a huge number of potential queries about SELinux. And so if you're using SELinux and something doesn't quite work right, you might ask about how do I change a Boolean to have this daemon be unconfined? How do I relabel the files? How do I change the policy? Whereas if you decide I'm giving up, then there's only really one question, and so that sort of outweighs the other queries just by aggregation. Also, there's a huge amount of people who just install SELinux without thinking about it and without even thinking about it. They install it running target policy. The machine either doesn't run Apache or runs Apache in the default configuration, and that means basically it just works for them, and so it works while asking questions. Also, Red Hat has done some really good work for writing manuals for SELinux. They have like manuals of like 300 pages, 400 pages. And there's a certain class of user who goes, well, I'm going to install technology, I want to read a manual first. And here's 400 pages, I'll read it, and it's indexed properly. And so you don't have to read it from start to finish, you just read the parts of the index that sort of match your requirements. And if you're that kind of person, you can just read the manual and have things just pretty much work by following the instructions. There's also a bunch of man pages as well. I think there's even on Fedora, there's a man SELinux. So man SELinux and lists other things you can refer to. So there's a reasonable documentation out there. There's at least three textbooks on SELinux out there, two in English, one in Japanese. So if you like reading books instead, you read these books, and again, you wouldn't do much in the way of web searching. IRC is also a reasonable support forum, and there's a bunch of people asking questions on IRC. There's also a sort of fan out of questions through the various Linux user groups, etc. So you have one person might learn from IRC and tell people their local like about it. So there's a lot of people who don't need to do searches on SELinux or don't search specific things. So even though it is a bad thing to have the number one search be how to turn it off, but that's not really a direct criticism, that's just a matter of noting what some people are doing. But I think the fact that the majority of Fedora users use SELinux without even knowing about it, I think it shows that SELinux can provide some benefits without being invasive. And of course, then if you want to have it provide more benefits, you can use a strict policy, which then involves some trade-offs of security versus the amount of effort you spend implementing it, and provides much greater security. Yep? Yep. Sure, yep. Okay, now this was a really good criticism back in... Okay, so the question is about how hard it is to write this Linux policy, and whether there are any tools to make it easier. Now, TreeSys and Red Hat working together have developed a couple of tools to do these things. I haven't actually used them much myself because I find Vi is such a great tool for writing policy that I haven't needed anything better than that, really. But eventually my aim is to get these tools in Debian, and it looks like I'll be the person packaging them, so therefore I've got to package them, I've got to actually test them, make sure they work. So I have to play with these soon. Red Hat guys say that these tools are designed to make things work reasonably easily for people who aren't experts. So that is basically, you know, if you have something denied by CLinux, there's a GUI tool to currently analyze the policy and analyze what the kernel is doing and tell you why it's denied. Domain A was denied access to file type B. And then you can pass this audit log data through another tool to generate a policy module. With policy module, then you load it into the policy database, and then it applies, and then the operation is permitted. One thing about the policy database is it's a significant change from the older version of CLinux. In the all versions of CLinux up to the release of Fedora Core 5, which was the first distribution supporting the new version, Fedora Core 4 and everything earlier supported policy, which basically a set of plain text files compiled. And if you want to modify a policy, you have to install a policy source, change text files, and compile itself. Which, for people like me, is really not a problem. I mean, I compile things every day, so compiling something else is no big deal. And for a lot of people using SLinux at the time, again, it wasn't a problem. There's a lot of users out there who just don't compile things, not what they do. And also, for users in corporate environments, you don't want to change a big binary ball of something that's been compiled to something else on your production network. It's a more viable option to say, okay, I've got this thing that came from the vendor, I want to leave it as is, I want to produce my own little thing that's really tiny, and just insert it in. And so this is what the binary policies modules do. You have your separate policy source file, which can be, as little as about 5 lines of text. So 5 lines of text, you know what it's about, you can partner with a module, you load it into the policy database, and it applies. And this module being separate from the main policy, if you upgrade the main policy, which periodically happens in Red Hat updates and Tenbox updates, they find things don't work and they add a new policy to allow them. So you can update the base policy while still keeping your changes in a separate module. And this works pretty nicely. And so there's GUI tools to implement most of this process. And I think that once these tools come out, I think, is Fedora Core 8 out yet? Okay, I was told that Fedora Core 8 is going to have a bunch of new tools to do some of these things and improvements to the tools. I haven't had a chance to try that myself yet. As I mentioned before, I use Vi, but I believe that the tools in Fedora Core 8 are simply improvements to what came before. So if you've tried these things before, like in Fedora Core 6 or Fedora Core 5, and things are too hard in terms of modifying policy, try Fedora Core 8, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Okay, more questions? Yep. You're right. I should just mention this stage. Fedora has now changed its name. It's not Fedora Core number, it's Fedora number. So we had Fedora Core 5, and then I think it was Fedora 6, and then Fedora 8 we're at now. Sorry about that. Yeah, question?
Yep.
Oh, yes. So the comment was about the Fedora 8 having a tool on your desktop to graphically display what changes might be needed to fix, if fix is the right word, an operation that's denied. Of course, one thing we have to keep in mind is that an operation being denied is not necessarily a problem, and not necessarily something that should be fixed. Often things are denied for legitimate reasons. So you don't want to fix globally, but a tool like that can have some real benefits in case of something's not working, and you know it's not working, and the tool says, it's not working because you have access to file A. Okay, well, I know file A should be read by this process, so therefore this is a problem to fix. Versus if you have something unusual like access to shadowed password file being denied, you'll think to yourself, well, probably this permanent net doesn't need access to shared password file, and therefore this is a legitimate denial and maybe an attack, maybe a bug, and I don't necessarily want to enable it. Excuse me for a second. Sorry about that. Okay, now, hopefully you can edit it out from the audio. What I should mention on this stage is one of the changes we had to make to PAM in terms of the shared password file. There was code in PAM previously to verify a password. It would say, if I'm not running as root and I'm verifying my own password, which is used for, say, screensavers, then we'll call a helper, unix_chkpwd. I'm just a set UID helper to just return a Boolean result, a password valid or not, and receive the password via an anonymous pipe. Now, the problem is, of course, with SE Linux, we want to have root-owned processes not reading the shared password file. This is a program to run as root, doesn't mean it has open privileges, and therefore we want to restrict its privileges as much as possible and not allow it to read the shared password file. So I had to remove this check for if UID not equals zero, and so even if it's UID zero, I would just check if the file is readable. So try to read the shared password file. If it's not readable, due to being non-root or due to SE Linux or whatever else, then it would run the set UID program, which also triggered a SE Linux domain automatic transition, and then had privileges to check it. This dramatically reduced the number of programs that need to read the shared password file on SE Linux. So at one stage I did a check, and there was in Debian about 27 different programs that need to read the shared password file in a fairly typical install of the entire distribution. So 27 programs versus how many root programs there are on a typical Unix system, hundreds, thousands. On a typical Unix system, you'd have Bash be run as root many, many times, and each copy of Bash could then read the shared password file. This isn't really what you want. Also, another thing is the issue of auditing. It's nice to have a list of all the processes reading shared password file and say each of these processes is going to be a target of attack. If there's 27 of them, I can look at the source code of 27 programs. It'll take me some time, but I can do it. I can't look at the source code of 1,000 programs or 10,000 programs. That's not possible at all. And so this means that it is possible to audit things in ways that it wouldn't be previously. And one of the goals of this Linux project, in fact, was to allow the policy itself to be audited as well. Treesys first became involved with this Linux development in developing tools to analyze policy. So one of their first projects was to analyze a Linux policy for a customer. Customer will know, is this policy achieving our security goals? Treesys decided to be a bit creative. They didn't solve this problem. They were a tool to solve the problem. And of course, the tool could be used on other programs as well and other problems and determine whether policies will meet the security goals. And one of the ways SE Linux works in this regard is that every file has only one type assigned to it, and every type will have specific access rules. And if you say, okay, a certain type, you can process, domain A can write to it, and domain B can retry it, for example, if that's how you want the data to flow. And then you have certain types assigned to be perhaps set UID executable equivalent or just regularly executable. And you can analyze the policy to make sure these goals are met. One problem with Unix missions is that there is no such model, and there's no way of analyzing the policy. And every file in the system can essentially be a breaking of security policy. Any file could be CH-owned and CH-modded to become a set UID program to break your security policy. And you can't tell which ones are. And also, there are chains of access control in Unix missions that are very difficult to discover in theory, and in practice, I'm not aware of anyone actually solving them. For example, just say you have a process which is set UID root, the file that is set UID root, and only a certain group can execute it. This is very common. You say, I only have a certain group of users who should be able to run this program, and it should be set UID root. That's a reasonable design for a certain class of program. And then you have another program which is set GID to that particular group. So, okay, if I can run that set GID program and then run set UID program, I can go to root, in theory at least. I'm not aware of any tool ever being written to analyze this. Whereas with SE Linux, there's tools to analyze these chains. And you can say, okay, give me a list of all types can be used for domain A to transition to domain B. And then give me a list of all types can be used for domain B to transition to domain C. And then you can find out which files have these types and whether they can be used in a hostile manner. So you can analyze how your policy could be possibly misused or worked around. Whereas the news permissions, it's just impossible. Okay, do you have more questions at this stage? Okay, I think I'm coming to the end, so I'll wrap the talk up now then if there are no more questions. Thank you for your time.